עוד שם תבקשי משאלה ואני אבקש חזרה ואם אתה שומע את קולי בחלום אני לא אוותר עליך והימים עוברים והלילות קשים הלב מדמה והנפש שלי כבר שבורה.
Bienvenidos al episodio 2 de la temporada 4 de Boy Friendly, soy pasante del Mossad. Este episodio va a ser todo en inglés porque se lo vamos a dedicar a los motochorros de la geopolítica y a todos los bananas antioccidente. Fue un episodio iluminador en muchísimos aspectos porque pudimos hablar con un iraní que fue preso político por ser disidente, que lo torturaron y que nos cuenta de primera mano, con mucho humor, a pesar de su tragedia personal, ¿cómo fue salir de la sartén de la Ayatola para caer en el fuego de los círculos progresistas del primer mundo cuando se logra escapar y obtiene después el estatus de refugiado en Canadá? Así que es vecino tuyo, más o menos, ¿no, Apu?
Sí, se trata de Siavash Safavi. Es un joven que creció, como dijiste, en Irán, originariamente de Teherán. Después se mudaron a un pueblo más pequeño porque los padres estaban involucrados en política. Luchó contra el régimen, según cuenta, todavía no estaba listo, no estaba lista la sociedad. Y yo lo único que voy a decir es, tira 20 títulos por minuto, como dicen los periodistas, vale la pena escucharlo. Y a mí me sorprendió que tengo más en común con él, que se crió en un ámbito completamente distinto, con una historia absolutamente diferente a la mía, pero con quien comparto más valores y objetivos de vida y actitudes como la libertad, el humor, que con los que supuestamente fueron compañeros de ruta en el pasado, cuando era más progresista.
Bueno, arranquemos entonces con este episodio. Le recordamos a la audiencia que es todo en inglés, pero que vale la pena y yo creo que es para escucharlo varias veces.
Adelante.
Welcome to Goy Friendly Season 4, Episode 2. We are recording this on February 12th. Yesterday, it was the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution in Iran that deposed the Shah and replaced it with a Muslim theocracy. And as part of the commemoration, Reza Pahlavi, the prince who lives in London, tweeted that he was surrounded by Iranians, joined by Israelis and Ukrainians who are joining on the fight for the liberation of Iran from the regime. So something is happening. We have been following in Goy Friendly the Ukrainian plight. We have been following, of course, all matters in Israel. And we thought it was a great idea to have somebody that could share what's going on in Iran, what has been going on. And we found somebody. His name is Siavash Safavi. He's currently a translator in Canada. And he has been a political prisoner during the uprisings 14 years ago. He came as a refugee to Canada. And he has very interesting insights of what is going on, not just in the Middle East or in West Asia, but also in the Western society. And Pasante, I don't know if you want to add something.
Well, like we've been discussing in previous episodes, there's something going on with Iran, or at least with the Ayatollah regime. And like you mentioned, there was a demonstration. There were several parties or people interested in joining forces who can picture themselves and ourselves as the people that like to live in a free world. But that's not enough. It's like, it's really easy to say, okay, we are the good people, they are the bad people. So how we can tackle the story of what's going on is just having a conversation with someone who suffered in his own body, to the Islamic regime of the Ayatollah. So I don't know, Siavash, if you would like to start by telling us, how was it growing up and living the Ayatollah's Iran, and how was the process until you managed to escape?
Well, that's like a half of my life.
Welcome.
like two-thirds of my life, so I'm going to summarize. I was born after the revolution, a few years after the revolution during the Iran-Iraq war. That generation of the 80s are basically referred to in Iran as the burnt generation because they had the worst of it when the Islamic Republic was at its worst, like darkest, like the, what was it in France, the era of terror or something, like the mass executions, the war, like it was pretty bad, really bad. I always say, like, one of the first things you're taught as a kid, especially when you start going to school, one of the first things you're taught is basically, you should basically learn how to lie, because your private life is different than what the regime wants. And you're not supposed to talk about what you do in the house, if your parents drink, if they don't agree with the regime, if all that stuff. So children are taught at an early age either not to talk about anything at all about their homes or to fake it. Then there is school. It's all ideological, a lot of ideological brainwashing since like second grade. The religious teachings start in second grade elementary. Then there is when you get to around like middle school, school prayers are mandatory. Become mandatory. You have to participate in the afternoon, noon and afternoon prayers. There is morning ceremonies every day, reading Quran, prayers, death to America, death to Israel, and all that. And the whole school system is basically designed to brainwash, but they're incompetent. So it really doesn't work. Some aspects of it sinks in a little bit for some people, like, for example, the animosity towards the previous regime, towards Shah. Until internet came along, most families whose parents were not like political or were not involved in politics in any way before the revolution, during the revolution, or were not that bright or informed, which are a lot of people, because it was basically Iran had a problem with a lot of people didn't have enough information. If they did, they would have never revolted. They actually thought Iran was basically the Iranian students who went abroad, were sent abroad by tax money to get educated and come back and build the country. They all became socialists, and many of them became agents of the Soviet Union. They were actually basically joined the Tudeh Party, which was the Soviet party in Iran. And then they came back and they were like, oh, the West is really rich. We're not. So obviously the Shah is stealing from us. It's like, okay. No. Like 40 years ago, Iranians had 1% of literacy and 10 kilometers of railroad. These things take time.
Right.
Basically, just to give our audience an idea, there was a moment where some intellectuals syndicated in the left side of the spectrum thought the Shah's regime was awful and collaborating with the capitalist system, and they wanted to tear it down. And how they merge with the religious.
Yeah, that's the interesting part, because they were the left in Iran. There was no freedom fighters in Iran. That was one thing that everybody misunderstands. It was basically the whole deal was more like Cuba.
Okay.
Then like France, there was no freedom fighters. It was Islamists and communists. Nobody was chanting like freedom, democracy. There was none of that. Okay. None of that. So that's the funny thing that nobody pays attention to. So socialists, communists mostly were funded and organized by the Soviets, and they were the ones who were pushing the idea of revolution. Khomeini even until like 1974-5, I want to say, did not mention revolution at all, because the religious were more conservative, and religion in Iran had always been under the rule of monarchy. So they were not like ambitious that way. But socialists, because Soviet was organizing them, and Soviet wanted to topple the regime of Shah because it was a nuisance, it wasn't either in the Eastern Bloc or the Western Bloc, but it was actually making Middle East its own bloc by creating OPEC and really gathering power, and was more friendly to the West. Soviets wanted to overthrow it. So what they did was they knew they wouldn't have enough support in Iran for socialists to overthrow the regime. So they needed the Islamists' support because they would have the lower class and masses.
Yeah.
And there was only one religious figure who was openly against the regime. Khomeini started his opposition to Shah when Shah gave the right to vote to women. That was Khomeini's first opposition to Shah.
Not like the kind of things that you would like to have as a partner if you're a lefty.
It doesn't matter. Okay. That's the thing. That's the funny thing, though. Yeah. When it's all about ideology and power, you'll get in bed with everybody, with anybody who might help you get power. And that's what they did. All these communists went behind Khomeini.
Okay.
And called him Imam. It was funny.
So we fast forward to a couple of, fightings in the streets and everything. Then the Shahs toppled down.
Yeah.
And
mass executions begin. Yeah. My family were political, so we also escaped to a small town.
Your family was original from which city?
Tehran.
You lived in Tehran, then you had to move. What was it like to grow up lying all the time about what happened at home and listening to all that?
It's weird. It's weird. It's really weird. You have to find your people. It takes a long time because children become friends easily.
Yeah.
Children find friends in everybody. Oh, there's a ball. All five of us are now friends. That's it. But when it's that situation, it has to be measured. Like, can I take this person home? How is his family? Like, there is a vetting going on, even as children.
But you actually knew as a child that you were in danger if a friend of yours found out.
No, my parents would be in danger. Like if I told, like in school, if I blabbed about like my dad drinking or my dad like opposing the regime, anything that my dad and my uncles or whatever talked about in their political things, that would be a problem.
What kind of things are a problem back then and also now in Iran? Because I knew about Iran and the repression, but recently I learned that you cannot dance in the street. Like, you can go to jail for that. So can you, for our audience and for myself, can you let us know what things you as a man and women also in particular cannot do and are punished by the state?
Yes. Well, it's kind of a flowing thing. It changes over time. Like when I was a kid, the reason I said we were considered like the burnt generation. When I was growing up, when I was like in elementary school, VCRs were illegal in Iran. Like, if they found out you had a VCR, police would rush in, raid your house, and take it, and they would charge you, like, either fine you or even put you in jail. It was usually to fine you, basically, for them to get more money, but, like, that was a crime. So, but over time, because Iran is a big country, big borders, you can't really control all the borders, they smuggle these things in. Satellite dishes, same story. The regime for a decade was just arresting and confiscating satellite dishes and fining people. And then it got to a point that like 80% of people had satellite dishes. So it just became a thing that the regime is like, no, but really they can't stop it. And Sharia law is the rule of the country. The official law of the country is the Islamic law. Now, it's the Shiite version, but it's basically the same exact thing with some interpretation. Shiite school allows some interpretation by the Ayatollahs. So, yeah, girls become adults at 9, boys at 15. Girls have to wear hijab, drinking alcohol, dancing, women singing, music in public in general, and dance music in public in general. All of these are stuff that are basically very commonly known that you're going to get in trouble for. These are normal, basic stuff that are known to everybody. That if I do this in the street, I have to expect trouble.
And what is the situation of religious minorities in Iran? In Argentina, we have in the year, I think it was 2005, Iran bought a PR tour from three guys who were leftist into Iran. And they showed, look, everything is great here. They even took them to a synagogue and they showed them, we have Jews and they are free to practice the religion.
We have Jews. You can't count them, actually.
Yeah. Like they 50. Don't say that Iran used to have, like, it was basically one of the, like, top five countries in the world, the Jewish population. And now there's like 2,000 to 8,000 left. Jews in Iran are kind of like those concentration camps that there was a guy in charge. A Jewish guy was in charge of the Jews in the concentration camp. So the leaders of that community are completely under the regime. Like, they're the reporters of the regime. Yes. That's why every time there is a report about Jews in Iran, it's a positive one. Because those in charge of the community are the ones who have completely sold their soul to the regime.
That's actually the same thing with what happened under the Nazi regime, that the leader of the community in the camp or in the ghetto was at the same time responsible for the lives of all the people. So it has, like, either to subdue to the regime or just surrender and be killed. But there's also this thing about what Apu said, Argentinians traveling to Iran and spreading propaganda.
Wasn't the Argentinian president tried for getting bribes from Iran or something? I don't remember. There was something like that.
Yes, we have two terror bombing attacks.
The AMIA thing. Yeah,
there was. '92, the embassy, deal. And '94, the community,
Jewish community center.
Yeah. Yep. And there was some sort of spurious arrangement to take the testimonies of the people involved in Iran in exchange for stopping the Interpol request for detention for those Iranians. But what I wanted to bring is actually this other thing that happened in Argentina recently, similar to what Apu shared. We had this guy was like some sort of flaneur journalist, backpacker, that became popular among the left progressives down here. And he became famous and infamous by sharing what happened in Iran, saying that, like, people were really nice and happy in the streets. And there was this thing that we all learned, that there's a great tarof in Iran, like poetry.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was like this guy built a huge pile of bullshit that it was so obvious, fed by the Ayatollah regime.
Yeah, the regime actually spends a lot of money on those. It's not like the regime spends a lot of money on those. Like, you see this porn star who just visited Iran. Okay, you get executed for that in Iran.
Yeah.
Okay, when a porn star is allowed to visit the country and report nice things, okay, if you believe this, you're a moron. And really, we can't even have a conversation at that point. It's like, okay, it's a porn star. They lash people for just having sex. You think porn star, what does a porn star get in Iran? It's execution. It's spreading corruption on earth. There is a charge for that. It's a legal charge called spreading corruption on earth.
Yeah.
which refers to anything from a porn star to somebody who runs a porn website or promotes removing the hijab, anything. That's the charge that they stamp on you, and the execution is the... It's like, yeah, they spend a lot on just these types of propaganda.
So they don't save money, and they have no moral problems hiring that kind of ambassadors
for
the regime, even though they are against the values of...
Khomeini very famously said, the Ayatollah who founded the regime, famously said, any sinful act is mandatory if it saves the Islamic regime. It's not just okay. It's mandatory. Any sinful act is mandatory if it saves the Islamic regime. So in order to save the Islamic regime, they will remove the hijab if they find it necessary. They're going to be toppled. They allow women to go without hijab. Anything to just save this regime. That's the whole ideology. So they will hire porn stars. They will hire Jews. They will hire anybody who just pushes their agenda. The whole Sharia law thing and the laws and what's forbidden and what's not. Women under Sharia law are also not allowed to, for example, run for president. They cannot be judges. They cannot be the leader. And their testimony is like worth half a man's testimony. In normal testimony, you need two witnesses. For two witnesses, these are men. For women, you have to have four witnesses, for example, to testify. But religious minorities that we got into, the worst who have it in Iran are the Baha'is. Because the Islam at least considers like Christianity and Judaism Abrahamic religions and claims to be coming basically the extension of them. But Baha'ism was basically an Iranian Protestant Islam. This guy, Baha'u'llah, came, like he said, I'm a prophet. This is my views. It was basically modernizing Islam and softening it and more basically Iranianizing it. They're not allowed, according to the religion, to get involved in politics. They're not even allowed to touch weapons. It's very soft, very nice, modernized version, emphasizes education and all sorts of things. And the Islamists, like this religion came like 200, 250 years ago. Islamists, it became very popular, so they started attacking and massacring them. So the Prophet escaped to Ottoman Empire. Ottomans found it that he was problematic. So they basically moved him to what currently is the state of Israel. That area, they moved him to, I think, Jerusalem.
Haifa.
Maybe,
the,
I don't
the
know.
The big Baha'i gardens are in Haifa.
Haifa, yeah. So because of that, Baha'is in Iran are not only a fake cult, which is trying to undermine Islam, considered enemy of Islam, but they're also automatically Jewish Israeli spies. So you being a Baha'i is a crime under Iranian law, under Islamic Republic law. Like literally membership in the fake cult. The word is worse than fake, but I can't find the translation in my head right now. But basically the evil, like malicious, whatever word, cult like of Baha'ism.
Like that's agents of Satan.
Basically, the malicious cult of Baha'ism. Membership, that's a crime. That's a title of a crime in Iran. So just being that is a crime. They have it the worst than anybody in that country. It's like, and they're not allowed to go to school, university. They're not allowed to have public jobs. They're not allowed to be hired in government or any position. And even when they try to have, for example, private universities to educate their children and whatever, they are raided and all the teachers are arrested. And it's like a teacher, like there are dozens and dozens of Baha'is in prison for teaching like math to Baha'is. It's like I laugh because I've learned not to internalize it because it's really heavy. So I just try to go through it without really getting deep in it, but it's unbelievable.
And wrapping up the minorities question, I think also Azeris from Azerbaijan, the minority, is also always suspected of spying. And what about the I think they are called Ahwas, the Arab minority in Iran?
No, there is, if we want to get into that, I have to give you a little bit of a background. Iran is a very, very unique country culturally. It was never a tribe becoming powerful and taking over other tribes and forcing them to join it and be under it and ruling over them for thousands of years. Iran was created by the alliance of Persians and Medes. Medes are the Kurds. Cyrus the Great came to power. He was half Mede, half Persian. He came to power and literally just the Median Empire just joined him. And it became the Persian Empire. And it was called the Persian Empire initially. Then it was the, after Alexander attacked, it was the Parthian Empire. Parthians were the Scythians who lived in the eastern areas. And Sistan and Baluchistan, which is a province in Iran, eastern province in Iran, those are the people. They ruled over Iran. Then there was the Sassanids who were in the south. They took over. After Islam, you had Azeris. Azeris were the ones who formed the new Iran. Azeris are not a minority in Iran, by the way. Like, Azeris ruled Iran for 400 years. They formed the new Iran after Islam. Turkmens ruled over Iran. Kurds ruled over Iran. Azeris and Baluch, all of these ethnicities have ruled over Iran, and all the other ethnicities followed them and supported them as the leader, because that's how Iran has always worked. Okay, you're the most powerful right now. You're going to be ruling. We're going to follow and support you because we're all Iranians. The whole separatist movements and such, ethnic identity movements, started under Shah by Stalin. Stalin started two movements in Iran, the Azeri separatist movement and the Kurdish separatist movement. Stalin himself actually started these two because there was none. So they started to pump these intersectional, importing these colonial concepts into a country that had its ethnic identities and national identities, and there was no colonialism. Each of them had helped form this identity, like they were part of it.
Classic Soviet Union move.
Yeah, there are Kurdish traditions that are being celebrated in east of Iran, and there are Turkish food that is being eaten in south of Iran. Like, it's a whole thing. And they tried to force import these ideas into a country that didn't, like, those ideas never fit in. So they were never successful. But they're very loud abroad, because that Ahwaz movement that you mentioned, that's the Arab one. Iranian Arabs, actually, according to Kashavi, who was like the Iranian historian, the biggest Iranian historian, who was assassinated by the first terrorist Islamist group in Iran, actually. He says Iranian Arabs immigrated to Iran 2,300 years ago. So they're actually before the Arab conquest, they moved to Iran. That's why they're Iranianized. They're not like Arabized. So I have lived in those areas. There is no like a ethnic, the regime in Iran doesn't have an ethnic bigotry. It has a religious bigotry. If you're a Kurd, if you're an Arab, the leader of the Islamic Republic is Azeri. Most of the leaders of the regime are Azeri. It's not about that at all, because the regime doesn't recognize ethnicity or nationality. Khomeini, one of the first things he said was, nationality is this Western imperialist idea. We're not a nation, millat, we're an ummah. Ummah is the religious nation.
The brotherhood, the big...
Yes, the brotherhood, religious brotherhood. So it's about Shiite versus Sunni. It's about Shiite empire. The Islamic Republic's idea was to become the kind of the Soviet Union for the Shiites in the world.
Now that you mention it, can you just summarize the difference between Shiites and Sunnis and how that makes them an enemy of the Saudis?
It's very interesting, actually. Yeah. That's also another thing that Iranians did because they were so angry with Arabs who came out of nowhere and just... They were considered barbarians at the time because they were warrior tribes. And Iran had its like empire for like 1,200 years. And then Arabs came with the message of like, yeah, you should bathe once a week. And Iranians were like, yeah, we know. And they were like, no, you should. But they were great warriors. And at the time, the Sassanid Empire was very weak after 20 years of war with Romans. And there was great turmoil. So the empire was defeated. So after a while, the Arabs had this whole thing that basically Muhammad was supposed to declare a, what do you call it?
A heir.
Yeah, an heir to replace him, but he refused. Now, most sources say he refused, but some say he declared Ali, his cousin, as his heir. So there were some who supported Ali as the heir, but most went with Abu Bakr, then Umar, then Usman. And after Usman was killed in an uprising, people went to Ali and they brought him as the next caliph. Now, after that, Hassan is Ali's son. He becomes the caliph, but he is defeated by Muawiyah, this other guy in Syria, who's very powerful, and he defeats him, and he becomes the caliph, and starts the Umayyad Empire, the main empire, Arab empire, that basically took over south, north of Africa, and moved all the way to Spain, and all that. Muawiyah started that, by defeating Ali's son. Shiites are the ones who say, Ali's line should be the only ones ruling. Sunnis say, no, it's tradition. Muhammad didn't choose a descendant, choose a heir. So that's how it went. Basically, it was a bit majority saying, yeah, this guy should be the caliph. And that's the main difference. But they were not a big deal at all. They were very small. What happens is Abbasids are from the same tribe as Muhammad. This is like 200, almost 150 years later, after Umayyad Empire has taken over most of the known civilized world. Abbasids are relatives of Muhammad from the same tribe. So they realize, Iranians realized that, okay, there is this animosity between Arab tribes over ruling. So Iranians went over and supported the Abbasids. Abbasids then take over with an Iranian general and take over, and then they start their empire, which lasted like 500 years. Mongolians destroyed it. And Iranians, since then, they were the ones pushing Shiites because they considered that a method to create division within the Arabs. And that's why Shiite really became a thing. It really wasn't. But because Iranians wanted to get in, like interfere with Arab politics, they made Shiites a thing.
So jumping ahead some centuries and skipping the Islamic Revolution, there was a point like 15 years ago. We're not going to get into details into how this started, if that's the point where it started. But we have been seeing that the society, mostly those that were coming out of age from the burnt generation, were now being young men like yourself, were revolting. So what was your experience with that? And then I have another question.
So, yeah, I'm sorry if I went into a whole historical tangent, but what happened was the internet. Because the regime controls information in Iran very, very rigidly. Like, there is no book published that is not approved by the Ministry of Islamic Guidance. That's the title. Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance. They have to approve any book, doesn't matter what it is. So there is not enough information. This is what I was talking about, that some things become internalized. I'm going to give you the example. I think maybe that's what you would be interested in. When I was like 17, 18, internet had just came to Iran. It was like Yahoo chat groups. I don't know if you remember them. Before they were flooded with pedophiles, they were still allowed a lot of them. And that was the first time I could chat with somebody abroad. And I remember I started chatting with people, but like when I would chat with people in US or Europe, when they would find out I'm from Iran, they would stop responding. But I noticed that Jews would not stop, would actually be interested. It was like, oh, you're from Iran? What's it like there? Like, what's going on there? So after a while, I was like, okay. I mean, I had a negative kind of a, it wasn't a thing. Like, my parents never, ever said anything negative about Jews, ever. But it's just from childhood, it's every day, it's like these Zionists are just killing children, and it's just like, it's like their hobby on the weekend. They just go, okay, let's go kill some children, like picnic and some, we'll kill some children on the way. Like, that's what you get actually in your brain.
As a child, you actually thought that Jews were like really evil and mischievous and...
I was an intellectual. I was like, I was talking to this kid. I was like very, and he was like, do you hate Jews? And I was like, no, I don't hate Jews. I don't like Zionists. But it was, I was like, I'm very open-minded. And he was like, well, do you know what Zionists are? What Zionism is? And that was literally the moment I was like, no, I don't actually. So what am I talking about? So I was like, no. And then he was like, yeah, this is Zionism. And I was like, oh, okay. That's okay, I guess. I don't think. But and that was literally one of the first times that I was really like, there was a punch. And I was like, oh, so there are things that this regime basically kind of implicitly, basically it's under a lot of things that you don't even notice. These biases are created over decades of hearing something negative about something. Even if you don't think about it, if it's not in your daily life, it just happened. It just created there. So that was the first time I was basically faced with it. And then I was like, oh, cool. So that's bullshit. Sorry if I'm not allowed to cuss.
No, yes, you're allowed. And by the way, so you just found out that Jews were not evil, and but you are still like a minority.
Yeah. Oh, no. I was a minority before that. Like, my parents were atheists. I had a very small group of people that were like my people, because I was an atheist. I was reading like sometimes a book a day, and I was listening to metal music because my cousin in Tehran, that was the type of music he was into, and he was my only rich family member, and he could like get these, we called them under the table music. So that was the music that he was into, so naturally that was the only music that was coming from outside, and I became a fan of that too. Metallica was actually the first one. So I had very, very few people that I actually could basically really connect with in that sense, because my parents were also studied in France, and they raised us in a very different way. Even though we were poor, we were not acting like the lower class that we were. So it was not fun.
And then internet came, and I was sharing at the beginning, before we started recording, I was telling you about my involvement with Iran, that with trying to reach out. So I was not the person that you contacted, because I was never able to do that. But I posted a lot about, in 2010, all the struggles, because I thought there has to be someone on the other side that now we can reach out directly to. And I even reported in my blog back then that two Israelis created a Facebook group called We Love Iran. We are from Israel and we love Iran. And in Haaretz, you can see this is a news from 2012 that...
I remember.
You remember?
I very well remember. We immediately started a campaign, Iranians Love Israel too. It didn't get big because we were way ahead of the Iranian community in that area. But that was something that blew up, kind of, and it had a positive impact. It did have a positive impact because a lot of the anti-regime activists still had those. But I had dropped mine a long time ago because my English was really good. And I was really interested in improving my English since childhood. Most Iranian activists' English were not good, so they were not in communication and whatever. So those biases existed for a lot of people. And those types of moves were the ones that forced them to look inside and be like, okay, why do I dislike them? And they were like, oh, okay, so it's because of the stuff that the regime has told me that they've done. And then they would go into it. Again, a lot of them didn't because Iran was dominated at the time by the reformists. I'm doing the air quotes for those who are listening. Yeah, reformists, so. And who are basically part of the regime. The part of the regime that say, hey, don't shoot them, just break their legs. Like, that's their level of, like...
Now that you bring it, what was the worst part of becoming a teenage or a young adult that forced you to leave your Iran? I mean, what happened to you? You were in prison or something like that.
Yeah.
Would you like to share that?
Oh, that was experience? During the 2009 Green Movement thing. I was a student activist organizer in our university. We were like the five of us were running the student association. After the election, 2 days after 2009 election, one of our secretaries, I was like, there were five of us, the secretaries of the association. One of us was kidnapped by the intelligence ministry because the riots were starting. And one of us was kidnapped. So we organized a massive protest in university to ask the dean to basically answer where this guy is, where his student is. And the next day we did it again, and the next day we were surrounded. The university was surrounded by police and army and IRGC and thugs. And we were arrested. Hundreds were arrested. Out of them, 30, out of them, 10, which one of them was me, were taken because we were the orchestrators and organizers. So we were taken to prison, court, trial, prison sentence, appeal. Again, prison sentence and lashes, and that's when we had like a month to surrender ourselves to prison, and we decided not to. And we were released on bail until the appeal result, and when the appeal result came, we were like, okay, I don't want to go back to prison. And at the time, the country wasn't ready, because we were anti-regime. We looked at reformists as a tool to create division within the regime. We knew this regime was irredeemable. It cannot be reformed. It's designed in a way to not be reformed.
What were the charges?
Public disturbance, insulting the supreme leader, and destroying public property, which were not at all. First of all, we were in a university, not a public area. And there was no destruction of public property, nothing. We were just having a protest gathering.
Siavash, after...
We did insult the leader, though.
Okay, well, that's not worth physical punishment, I think. But after you got through that experience, which I think it's I can't imagine, honestly, having your body surrendered to someone else, doing whatever they want. Because
prison was rough. Yeah, prison was rough. There were like interrogations. I got a good beating. I still call it a beating. The UNHCR human rights lawyer told me it was torture, but I still maintain that it was beating because we consider torture to be next level. Torture is what people die under. Okay. I got a good beating, but...
Did that break you to the point to say, okay, I'm going to apply as a refugee and leave the country? That was the moment.
I didn't want to leave. My parents and I had gotten married at the time. Had just gotten married. My parents and my ex-wife were basically the reasons that I agreed to leave. They were kind of like, there is no future for you here, because they had already told me you're not allowed to basically, I wanted to go into MA, study master's, but they were like, don't waste your time. The security officer told me, don't waste your time. You're not going to get accepted. You're all flagged.
You went with the help of the refugee, the High Commissioner of Refugees of the UN, the agency that actually tries to solve the problems of refugees, not like UNRWA, you were able to come to Canada. I have two questions. Yeah. The first one is, when did you meet the first Jew in real life, and when did you meet the first Israeli, if you have? That's question number one. The second one is the experience you had in the gender studies at York University, but that's a different topic.
Oh, okay. So I stayed in Turkey for 2.5 years, enough to watch Erdogan basically change the country into an Islamist country. And when I came to Canada, I would say pretty early on, I met a Jewish person, but I became, my first friend here was a Jewish, I started doing stand-up comedy. And there was one comic, because the stuff that I talked about, it's not easy to get over. I'll tell a story, and it's about some messed up shit, but it's funny stuff in it. But a lot of times people couldn't get over the messed upness of the situation to get to the laugh, and their looks were just horrified. So it took me a long time to get over and learn how to say it so they're not afraid. But the only other person that I saw was like, there was this comic, maybe you've heard of him, Daniel Boardman. He was doing comedy at the time, and he had a story, he had a joke about like going to Jewish school and getting bomb threats, and the school would be off, and they'd all be like, yay, bomb threats. And like, I would laugh my ass off, and everybody else was like, what the hell? And I was like, because I got that, like that, yeah, that's a messed up situation. But when you grow up in it, it's funny. It's great, even. Yeah, we got bomb threats today. Like, we're not going to school. That's awesome.
They say that comedy is tragedy plus time.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like therapy at some point. Humor is something that
absolutely
helps you go through stuff. Yeah.
Like when I got lashed, I remember one of the things I always tell people, try to explain to them, because when you get say, I got lashed, everybody was like,
yeah.
And I'm like, no.
They put a face like,
yeah. I was like 19. And I literally remember waiting outside the courtroom. My friends came for moral support, and they were all telling me their lashing stories. So it's not like this thing. It's just this thing that happens.
Yeah. Like a bachelor party, like what in Argentina they used to do to the bachelor party.
Yeah, it's like they're telling me like, hey, man, if they have the like this type of lash, your ass is fucked. But if they got this one, that's good. Like, it's part of life. It happens.
Yeah, but now that we are laughing at this tragedy, it makes me think that we are way ahead of the people that really get serious. The lack of humor and the resentment is organized through the idea of toppling down capitalism and the Western societies and bringing something. And they ally and they support the regime that did that to you and that also wants to destroy Jews
and
Israel.
The biggest joke is Michel Foucault, the great Michel Foucault, the postmodernist philosopher, called the Islamic revolution in Iran the first postmodern revolution in the world.
Go figure.
Okay? These are the types of people we're dealing with. So the basically that Daniel was the first one that I was like, oh, he's telling the story the way I tell the story from inside the thing, and he sees the funny in it. Then yay, we have bomb threats. We're off today. That's awesome. Like he sees it. So I literally went to talk to him afterwards, and I was like, hey, what's up? What's happening? We started talking, and we immediately hit it off, and I was like, yeah, we should do a podcast. And he was like, I'm doing this sports thing, and I was like, no, you're doing a podcast with me. So we started doing this podcast. We were doing okay, and then Facebook shadow banned us, so it all went away. And he's now doing his thing. It's pretty good. He has, like, Daily Telegraph, I think. And that's basically the first Jewish person I met. And we immediately hit it off. Immediately hit it off.
Where was he
I actually
from?
Made him way more Jewish than he was before. Because I'm really into traditions and value of traditions. And he was more of a modern Canadian Jew. And his family did observe the traditions and stuff, but they were not like religious. So it has a not that level of commitment, I would say, from his angle, for Daniel's, not that level of appreciation, I would say. And he admits it, that I made him actually appreciate those traditions, like the tradition of sitting around a desk, like around the table, and just criticizing your past year, like the mistakes you made in the past year. I was like, do you even understand how freaking amazing that is to have as a tradition to literally review your mistakes for a year? And it's like, nobody has that. That's freaking awesome. And he admits it, that I actually made him more Jewish. So.
Yes, and there are a lot of things in our traditions, like in Pesach, the idea of everything is so pedagogical, so it transfers from generation to generations. And the idea of taking a festivity, which used to be public, and with shows and killing some animals and party, to take that into private life in a family was an invention of Jews. Now it's very normal to say, oh yeah, Christmas, we're meeting with our family to celebrate, or Passover, we're doing it with the family. 1,000 years ago, it was not common to get together as a family to celebrate something. Things were in the open.
In general, yeah, definitely. Definitely, Jews have a lot of those very strong... Basically, that's what helps you survive. That's what helped you survive. It's like, okay, who messed up last year? Let's go through it. Okay. And back then, messed up was like, yeah, we lost like 50 people. What happened? Let's go through it. Play by play. Okay.
But Daniel was Canadian, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, Canadian.
And the first Israeli that you met? And then the York University gender studies.
Yeah, I think it was during that time, because I started to go, basically, I kind of, me and Daniel started to go to Jewish events and stuff to meet new people who wanted to be like more politically, because I went to university there. And okay, let's get to that. And it was like, I went to university, and I told this recently, that I don't use the term traumatized lightly. And like when I was beaten up in prison really bad, like my face was getting bashed against the floor, and then I went to the shower and just friggin' cried. I would say I was traumatized, but not really, because I knew where I was. I knew I was living under Islamic regime, this regime that has massacred tens of thousands of protesters and prisoners and friggin' doesn't care about anything and anyone. And I knew I was going against it. So I kind of expected something. It wasn't out of nowhere. Somebody just grabbed me and took me and started beating me. I knew the context. I was still traumatizing, but at least I could digest it, the trauma.
You don't see yourself as a victim. It's just the consequence of your acts.
Yeah, it was traumatizing, but at least I can digest it. I was like, yes, it was horrifying, but I knowingly got into it. Now, it was still way beyond what I had expected. I didn't expect them to bring in like a murderer necrophiliac into our cell to rape us. And luckily, he didn't. But like there was a lot of stuff that I didn't expect. But still, I expected something. When I came here, when I went to university here, I was starry-eyed. Like, it was a year after I came to Canada. I was fully in, like, yay, freedom of thought, freedom of expression, Canadian university, free discussions about anything, and all that's movies that you've seen, and all that shows that you've seen, discussing these complex issues and stuff. And I always dreamed of that. So we went in, and like it was, and I considered myself a feminist at the time. So because I translated a lot of like domestic abuse texts to help women and all sorts of things to help women. My mother was had a charity for abused women and all that. So I went into university. I wanted to see like where Western thought is right now. So I took gender studies, anthropology, and satire. Satire because I loved comedy, and I just, if it wasn't for comedy, I couldn't have survived. So gender studies, I went in and like, I was traumatized. Like after like a few weeks, I was like, this is fucking crazy. The first thing that came to my mind, I don't know if you've seen Star Trek, the Borg. The first thing that came to my mind, the Borg is an entity in Star Trek that there's this civilization that all the people's brains are directly connected. It speaks as one, it thinks as one, and it just wants to destroy anything that can't assimilate and assimilate everything else. That's
it. It's like a hive.
It's exactly a hive, but mechanical hive.
Okay.
That takes biological things as its operatives. Their brain is hijacked by the hive.
That was your experience at your...
I literally would joke. I was like, you will be assimilated. That was the Borg's slogan. You will be assimilated. Resistance is futile. That's their thing. And I was like, Jesus! Like, this lady, a professor, is arguing with me over biological differences of men and women. And I was like... But we know there are differences, right? She was like, no, medicine has been wrong throughout history about women's bodies and stuff. And I was like, yeah, but that was when we didn't know what microbes and bacteria was. Now we know more. And even if they make a mistake, it's not intentional. It's because they don't know, they're learning. But we know for a fact that if you find a 6-foot man and a 6-foot woman, both 180 pounds, take out their hearts, the man's heart is going to be 15 to 25% bigger than the woman's heart. His lungs are also going to be 20 to 30% bigger than the woman's heart. That's a fact. We know this. And she was like, that smile and a dismissive head jolt. And then they were kept like in their assistant professor's class. It was like symbols of patriarchy. Everybody was saying some BS. You're supposed to present it in the form of question. Now, in that class, I had written something before, like a question about, I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was, imagine if I'd said like, okay, I prefer the living room. And some student got up and said, why do you hate bathroom? Like, that was the type of interaction that happened. Like I said, is matriarchal society good? And somebody got up and said, what's wrong with it? And I was like, no, I'm just asking, is it preferred? And I said, no, I don't think you understand my point. And the professor caught me off and said, you can't say that. And I was like, say what? And she was like, that she's wrong. And I was like, but that's what I've written here. And she's saying something completely different. So she's wrong. And she was like, you can't say that. That's her understanding, interpretation of what you've written. It's all valid. That's literally what she told me. This is what I'm going through, dude. First year in Canada. Freedom and all that stuff. I'm still like starry-eyed and shit. And I'm listening to these mental deficit disorder people saying these things. And then she was like, okay, ask questions about symbols of patriarchy. So I said, can hijab be considered a symbol of patriarchy? It's a fair question. It's not aggressive. It's just a question. 4 or 5 students, 18-year-olds, got up. A couple of them hijabi. The rest, like one of them was a lesbian, very proudly, loudly admitting. I don't know why, nobody asked. And they just started mobbing and like, you're ignorant, you're a bigot, you're an Islamophobe, you're a bigot. And I'm like I'm at the time, I'm like 32, 3. I'm an adult and I've seen some shit. And these are 18-year-olds who literally came from high school here, have seen nothing in their lives. And it wasn't just that they did that. It wasn't just that the professor fully allowed it to happen, said nothing to stop it. It was that they were so comfortable doing it. Like, that was their entitlement, to get up and say horrific shit to somebody they have no clue who he is. And I was like, oh, this is their freaking, they're creating in their universities. So how long has this been going on?
How do you characterize this cult? They do not allow free speech. They have answers for everything under some prison. And the mob part, I think, is also very important, because it's not like, oh, I don't want to hear you. No, they will attack you.
Oh, yeah. No, they will silence you, because like every cult or ideology, okay, there are going to be holes in your argument, okay? Because no ideology by itself is enough, because the world is not basically limited to one place, okay? So different places have different traditions, cultural things, and characteristics. In Iran, we don't have a Zamboni department in any municipality, okay? Because snow, big snow is not a big thing. Like in northwest of Iran, a little bit, but not really. So different ideologies fit different areas and cultures and whatever. So nobody has the full answer, but because it's an ideology, they have to respond to the holes that they have. So that's how their philosophizing created. But this one is just like, no, why waste time trying to justify and friggin' answer and all that? Just, we will destroy the person who asked the question.
After that, you bought a ticket back to Tehran because it was a better dictatorship, like, I think.
Yeah, we're like in university, I've always said that in Iranian university, we had more intellectual discussions. You know why? Because we knew the professors. Okay, we knew who's a rat and who is not a rat. The response there was, if you said something outrageous, okay, you were not going to discuss this supreme leader. Why would you discuss it? We would discuss philosophy and stuff like that. And it was totally fine. Anything beyond, basically anything up to the supreme leader and the validity of Islam was basically okay to talk about in our universities. And even Islam, you could discuss like, okay, hadith, is this hadith valid or not or whatever. You could play a little bit if you were smart. You knew how to play with it without, because you know the language and how to dodge the red button stuff. But here, the idea is you're free. It's freedom. Yeah, you're attacked as a bigot for asking a question, not even statement, a question.
How do you think things are going to turn out after all this and after 7th of October and all the rise in anti-Semitism, which is like the B-side of what you experience as someone that lives.
Hey man, I've been telling Jews for years, okay, in Canada, we went to different Jewish groups and accounts and whatever, and we've been talking, and I kept saying, your day is due and you don't even see it. You don't even see what's happening in universities. You're clueless. You're running around after far right, which like in America, they did a call to arms across the country of 350 million people and 2,000 people showed up with tiki torches in a country of 350 million people. And you hold those as the boogeyman while in your universities, they are openly promoting this idea that Israel is this evil state and these corporations are evil, media is run by the devil people and all that stuff. it's normal as science, as education is being taught in your universities. Not as some fringe thing, but as education. So you've had like at least 20, 30 years of these things being pumped into universities. Bad times are coming. Like I'm happy that people are waking up, but this is not something that happened yesterday. You're seeing just the beginning signs of what started 30 years ago. Your beginning results of that long process is just showing itself. So we have a long way to go. Things are going to get worse before they get better, and we need to organize fast.
I'm a bit speechless, not because I didn't know about this, but you explain it with such contundency and power that I do.
Sorry
have...
to bum you out, man. I'm sorry bum you out, but no, we've been yelling this, screaming this out of every place. It's like, wake up, it's bad.
I have been for some time, not as long as you, and this is one of the reasons we wanted to have you on the show, I was going to say.
Yeah.
Because you have a first-hand experience of a cultural shock there. I did not attend college or university here in North America. I do have one question still. I see that Iranians are marching against the regime. And as you told, thanks to new means of communication, like the internet or satellite TV or cell phones, you get to know Jews, Israelis, and you say, okay, maybe they don't have horns and a tail. Maybe what I have been indoctrinated is not true. What is different in the Iranian culture from the Arab political culture, where at least for us, we have a joke that two Jews have three opinions. It is normal for us, it is encouraged in us to have a different opinion. If you just repeat what the other guy said, that's like, dude.
It's not a conversation, it's an echo.
Yes, and Talmud also incites us to look for the error in the other person's reasoning. So for that, you need to listen to him, understand, and try to find the flaws in his reasoning. So that's the training. I mean, I'm not saying that I studied Talmud, I didn't. But it comes, it can kind of...
We love to argue.
Yeah, but we see that...
Yeah, that's not a well-kept secret, everybody.
Right. And for what I have been talking with other people in the Arab world, it's more of a herd behavior. You should not step away from the herd. Even if you have doubts, you should not say them out loud. So, personally, this is my impression. Iran lives in the intersection of Muslim war, but they are not Arabs, or mostly. You said there are some minorities.
There's like 2 million Arabs in Iran.
Yeah, but the culture is different.
The country is 85 million people, so 1 or 2 million is a very small minority.
It's diluted. So what is different in the Iranian world that quickly, even if you have been indoctrinated all your life, you listen and you say, okay, maybe what I've been taught is indoctrination and not the truth. Well, when I try to speak, and I do it in Twitter with Arabs, it's very difficult. Some do because they have lived in the West for some time, but most don't.
Yeah, that's a very interesting, that is something I noticed a few years ago. Again, because I'm a fan of history, I love history. So I went through history of Iran and I actually reviewed it. And I was like, oh, that's because I was wondering what happened that after the revolution, people did that fast adjustment into these brutal, crazy people. And it was like, oh, this has happened in our history over and over and over again. So Iranians have had this because it was a big... rich empire, a lot of people kept attacking it, and sometimes they won. Arabs attacked it, Mongolians attacked it, Alexander attacked it. Like they all conquered it. Arabs, Mongolians, Alexander, Afghans even at some point, although they were part of Iran, but Turkmens, like all these groups would conquer Iran, and many of them were very culturally violent, let's say. If you said anything that they didn't like, if you did anything that they didn't like, they immediately cut your head off. So people over time learned how to adapt quickly to changing situations and immediately adjust themselves with it. Because when you can't reason with the guy, you just have to adjust. When Mongolians took over Iran, they killed about 3/4 at least to 4/5 of the population. Massacre, like a fifth or, and some say a fifth or an eighth of the population was survived after Mongolians. And guess what? I believe those were probably those who surrendered, and those were the ones who knew how to adjust. And it's like over time, it becomes part of the historical like identity of you that you immediately recognize the situation, adjust yourself. Now, with relation to Jews, with relation to the Jewish reception in Iran, it was negative for a very long time because Islam had roots in Iran and was very powerful in Iran, and it comes with anti-Jewish. I don't like the term anti-Semitism, but because it also includes Arabs who are Semites. So, yeah, I like to say Jew hatred or anti-Jewish sentiment. So Islam comes with Jew hatred. Like, it's in the whole thing. Like, prophets' last words are like basically something like, yeah, screw those Jews. That's like his last words. It's like,
we always like to make friends, yes.
Yeah, it's not good. It's not good, but guys, it's not good. So it was in the culture, in the ether. It wasn't hatred, but it was like, yeah, we should keep away. But what happened was Islamic Republic, one of its foundations, one of its pillars was anti-Zionism, anti-Israel. It was one of its founding pillars. Because of that anti-Jewish sentiment that exists in the Muslim communities, the regime smartly realized, okay, they can take advantage of this because Shah had good relations with Israel. Okay? And he was proud of it. It wasn't like Egypt that was kind of like, okay, you defeated us and then you let us win a war so we can have a relationship. But Shah was unapologetic. He was like the dad of the region. And he was like, yeah, I manage all of it. Like, you guys, Arabs, you can boycott anybody you want, but I'll keep the relationships going so there is no problem, there's no war. And that was something that the mullahs took advantage of. Really pumped it up. Shah is Israel's this and Israel's that. Although Shah was like, it wasn't like buddy buddies. He was like, yeah, it's a country we need relations with. So one of the pillars was that. I'm sorry if I'm rambling. But then what happened was, after the Green Movement went away, it was defeated because Green Movement was the last reformist movement in Iran that the reformists took control of, and it died out immediately because people were not real. They realized reformists don't want to really change anything. They just want to be in power in the key positions. So when the real uprisings against the regime started in 2017, one of the smart things that some people might not like, but one of the smart things that Netanyahu did was he started messaging Iranian people directly, addressing them after the uprising. He immediately realized that was a very smart move. He realized the opportunity of creating a counter narrative to the regime, because the people are rising against the entirety of the regime. And one of the chants of the people in the street was no to Gaza, no to Lebanon, my life for Iran. That was the main chant of 2017, which became the main chant in 2019. In 2017, there were two chants: no to Gaza, no to Lebanon, my life for Iran. And the second one was reformists, fundamentalists, your game is over. basically, we're not playing in this thing anymore. Vote for the reformists and vote for the fundamentalists. The regime had this game going for like decades.
And in the stadiums, I've seen videos.
Oh, yeah. Those are more recent.
Can you tell about that?
That was after October 7, because, as I said, because of the Gaza situation and the regime keep, like, when you're, since you're a child, the regime pumps this resistance ideology and Palestine and all that. So when people start hating the regime because of its incompetence and everything, Israel actually has that to thank for the regime, actually, because when people start hating the regime, they're going to start hating every narrative that it's pushing. And the main one that is a lot of its money is being spent on is the Israel-Palestine situation and Gaza and Hezbollah and Kataib al-Haq and Fatemiyoun in Iraq and Heshta Shabi in Iraq and Fatemiyoun in Afghanistan and Houthis in Yemen. And like, all of these are regime proxies. And it's like, hey, man, we don't have water in like south of Iran. What are you doing? So that helped a lot. With the change of the, and then the people were like, oh, okay, so this regime that is screwing us over this hard and lying to us about everything is really supportive of those guys and hates Israel. You know what? Fuck those guys. Good on Israel.
And the chant in the stadiums?
Yeah, after October 7th, the regime immediately started to basically thought that it can take advantage of the sentiments after Israel started to attack Gaza. So they brought this big flags of Palestinian whatever. I don't know if it's the Palestinian Authority or Gaza or whatever. That flag thing. They brought it in the stadium. Some IRGC Basij people, they started thinking. And like it's Azadi Stadium, like it's 100,000 people. And these are not upper class intellectuals or whatever. It's just football fans. It's usually middle and lower middle class. They all chanted all together, shove that Palestinian flag up your ass. It rhymes. That's why it's said twice, because it rhymes. Well, everything in Persian rhymes. Yeah, everything in Persian rhymes, by the way. Every chant rhymes. But yes, that started with 2017 with the No to Gaza, then got bigger and bigger because also Netanyahu and a lot of activists saw the opportunity to change a whole culture because the regime still had this narrative going with a lot of leftist Iranians who opposed the regime, but still, because they're leftists, they hate Israel because that's part of the whole ideology. Marx was a huge anti-Jewish, like Jew hater, even though he was Jewish, but he was a big Jew hater. So that also shut up a lot of Iranian leftist activists, because when they saw Iranians in Iran chanting like that in every street, that completely, like in online space, like after October 7, you didn't see any active, even those who like a few months ago were writing these like epic stuff about like Palestine and stuff. None of them, a peep out of any of them, because they didn't dare, because they knew anybody who supports Palestine or Gaza or Hamas openly, people will immediately cross them off. Immediate. Because we're at a revolutionary stage now. It's a stage that all the bonding things between the state and the people has been broken. All of them. Anything that happens in Iran, if tomorrow lightning hits somewhere, people will kind of some sort of connect it to the regime, blame it on the regime. We're at that level. And people are not forgiving at this level if you try to create nuance. Like, yeah, but Israel, if they should do like commandos, no, done. You're done. Immediately.
They have poisoning our water and all that stuff that there is the old age.
Yeah.
Siavasha, you know, I was pessimistic by the middle of our conversation, but then I gained some optimism about what you're telling right now. Apuchu, we could spend like another full hour or more.
We can do this again later in another time. I do have to get to work, but I just wanted to say something. One thing that Israel, like Israelis, Jewish community in America, the Jewish community has realized it and is doing it. And Israel also is realizing it because they did invite the Crown Prince to Israel. The Crown Prince visited Israel and many officials visited, and the Israeli minister of, I think it was security, national security or whatever, or defense, I'm not sure. They were basically hung out throughout the whole thing and a few days and visited with Bibi and everything. But the only movement, which is the absolute majority, but it doesn't have media, well enough media. It has social media and grassroots power, but doesn't have the NGOs. And it's the nationalist Iranian movement. It's the constitutional monarchists. Mm-hmm. And even if they're not constitutional monarchists, they accept the Crown Prince as the spokesperson for the revolution, as the leader of the revolution, until the free election happens. They've all agreed on that. Free election happens, we'll choose the form of the next government. But until then, this guy, because we trust this guy, he has unblemished resume, has never made a wrong move or decision, always has been correct, made correct predictions and made correct moves. So they trust him. And he comes from a really patriotic family who have great, like one of the biggest chants in Iran is basically sending blessings to his grandfather's soul. Literally, it's the biggest chant in Iran. So Israeli and Jewish community supporting the Crown Prince and basically allowing his voice to be heard more. He is doing great, but if that is recognized, that is the best future imaginable for the region, for Iran and Israel. It's so bright, it's blinding.
We'll make sure the Argentinian president takes note of that because he likes to revolt. And
yeah, there's a lot of obstacles in that way. But if that is recognized, because Iranians who are nationalists love their country and like Israel.
Wow.
They're actually like Israel. That's become kind of, we have a few checks, basically, when they say, okay, is this guy really a revolutionary or not? One of them is like, has he ever supported Qasem Soleimani, for example? Has he ever done this? And one of them is Israel check. That has been a thing for like 2 years now, Israel check. Soleimani check, Israel check. Like, has he ever talked trash about Israel and like the Palestinian resistance and all that stuff?
He's not a revolutionary.
He's not real. He's from that same ideology that brought that revolution. He's just a different format of it. People are very unforgiving right now in Iran for anybody who resembles any thought to that 1979 people, that leftist and the Islamist ideology.
And the Crown Prince is the person that I opened the episode with.
Yeah.
He was welcoming the Iranians yesterday and the Ukrainians and Israelis.
Oh, he visited Israel and
I know. I follow him. Ooh. I follow him on Twitter. I retweet his messages.
We should bring him to Argentina, definitely.
Yeah, and I will send you a picture with the monarch, a constitutionalist that I supported here in West Vancouver. Yeah, we definitely, that's, in my opinion, the guy that can bring the Iran to the post-Islamic era and a new Middle East.
Wow.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Let's hope we all get to see that. And I think it's a nice wish to just wrap it up. And let's say that we enjoyed a wonderful conversation, which was the...
Thank you. I enjoyed just yapping about myself for an hour.
You know, we like to fancy ourselves about being really like cosmopolitan and know many languages. Yeah. But I don't know how to say thank you in Farsi.
Sepas.
Sepas. Okay, so Siavash, Sepas. It was really, really, really a great pleasure for us. Thanks for your time and for all the stuff that you shared. We'll do all we can to just let people know about your story, about the struggle of the Iranian nationalists.
This was fun. This was fun. Thank you. I didn't know what to expect.
Well, I hope
you like it.
We hope you enjoy it.
We'll talk again. Okay. Have a good one.
Thank Bye-bye. You. Have a
Thank
good
you.
One. Bye bye.
Bye.
love.